And welcome back to Coast, sitting in for George Norrie, who's taking a much-deserved night off. And we are talking with Don Jeffries, author of Hidden History. His latest, incidentally, is called Survival of the Richest. Just another sort of did-you-know piece on Jack Kennedy, because we're talking about his assassination. And in just a few weeks, sort of the final dump of records as decreed by the Assassination Record Act that was signed back in 1992 by President George Herbert Walker Bush. With a phone call to Hollywood, John F. Kennedy actually got a movie made, and not just any movie. It was one that highlighted the tensions between the peace and military factions within his own administration. It was called 7 Days in May, starring Kirk Douglas and Burt Lancaster. It was based on the 1962 novel of the same name, about a Joint Chiefs of Staff plot to overthrow the president for supporting a nuclear disarmament treaty. And Kennedy wanted to raise the national consciousness about the problems involved if generals get out of control. And he was eager to get the movie made. So he actually decamped to Hyannisport and turned over the White House grounds to the filmmakers for a whole weekend. And they even allowed them to stage riots. So now you know. All right. I want to talk to you about George Norrie's other project. It's called Beyond Belief TV. And you can join George for dynamic discussions on paranormal phenomena, conspiracies, and all things unexplained. Beyond Belief. You can start enjoying episodes right now. It's real easy. All you need to do to sign up is visit beyondbelief.com. Back to my conversation with Don Jeffries, JFK assassination researcher. Reminder, bottom of the hour, we'll open the lines to you right here on Coast to Coast AM. Don Jeffries stays with us, and again, a reminder, bottom of the hour, we will open the phone lines to all of our Coast to Coast AM listeners, and you can have at Don with questions and comments as we continue to delve into the JFK assassination. Don, the author of Hidden History, his latest is Survival of the Richest. I have so many things I want to ask you, Don. Sometime I'm just going to, I'm going to come down there to your place I'm gonna lock the door and order in some pizza and just have at you for like 6 hours with questions. But I want to ask you about the James Elkins photograph, very famous AP photograph taken in the doorway of the Texas Book Depository building. And it's, I believe, in the foreground you can actually see, if I'm not mistaken, what appears to be, it looks like at this point Kennedy is reaching for his throat. It seems to me you can see a hand coming up to his throat. In the background, there is someone who looks all the world like Lee Harvey Oswald. What do you make of the Elkins photograph? Is it Oswald in the doorway?
Well, boy, that's one of the perfect examples of what I talked about the neocon debate. many of the critics, probably the majority of the critics, have given way on this issue, where they almost all to a person believe it was Billy Lovelady, who was a real Oswald lookalike. And supposedly there's a story that that Lovelady actually fooled Oswald's family, or Oswald fooled his family, something which I find impossible to believe, but they did look alike. But critics have just bought this story, and if you go back to read, Harold Weisberg did a great job on this, I believe in Whitewash 2, where he just tore apart the Lovelady's misleading statements, and I believe it could very well be Oswald. I don't think it's, at the very least, it has not been proven conclusively that it was Lovelady. But you've got a whole, because this is a crucial photo, because it actually made the mainstream news, because everyone realized, because as you said, you can see Kennedy reaching for his throat. It was taken at about the time of the first shot, most people believe. And here you have the supposed assassin standing in the doorway of the building when he's supposedly shooting from 6 floors above at the exact moment that Kennedy was shot. So clearly, that would be the greatest evidence of Oswald's innocence that you could find. But then now you have another controversy called Prayer Man. There's so many things involved here, where there's a shadowy figure in the background that some of the people that believe it was Lovelady standing there, but actually believe Lee Harvey Oswald was standing in the shadows, and they call him Prayer Man because of the way he was standing. But these are the kind of controversies that would have been resolved if you had a real investigation back when the trail was hot, right? Which, and when it should have been investigated. But instead, we know from the Nicholas Katzenbach memo on November 25th, when Oswald's body was not even was still warm after he'd just been killed by Jack Ruby, that the public must be satisfied that Oswald was the assassin, that he had no Confederates at large, and he was sending this to Bill Moyers, LBJ's aide and later future PBS journalist. Just informing the public, they couldn't have been any clearer or more blatant about it that there was not to be any investigation. So those kind of things would have obviously been investigated. They would have enhanced the photo to the best of ability back then. But they didn't ask any of these questions. Instead, there was a rush on. They saw this photo. The figure did look like Oswald. Incredibly fortunately for them, they had a real Oswald lookalike there, and the photo is just unclear enough to where, okay, it could be Lovelady, but it certainly looks a lot like Lee Harvey Oswald. I don't think the question's been resolved at all, and I think it could very well be Oswald.
Well, speaking of multiple Oswalds, how many were there, and were there deliberate plants? Because we have claims that the Oswald that was repatriated after he had supposedly defected to the Soviet Union, then he's repatriated. They even published the check, I think, in one of the Warren Report volumes, that there was this discrepancy in the height. And then we have, as you mentioned, Judith Baker, who claimed that she was dating an Oswald. Maybe she was. Maybe it was one of the doubles. How many Oswald doubles were there?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, there certainly were Oswald impersonators, and John Armstrong has written a privately published book that's difficult to obtain and expensive. I've read it and written about it, Harvey and Lee, where he postulated that there actually was, and it was actually, they were part of an intelligence project from the time that they were very young. There was Russian-born Harvey, who was the person that we know of historically that ended up being assassinated, and there was an American-born Lee. And he went back in the childhood, and I was just fascinated by it because he found dual school records, and you had the Lee Harvey Oswald, supposedly one Lee Harvey Oswald, being in different schools in different parts of the country at the same time. Lots of Oswald school records were unable to be found or remained classified. These are the kind of things that make people wonder. And if you look at the photos, the late Jack White, who was a wonderful researcher and did great work in photographs, he's the first one that he published called The Many Faces of Lee Harvey Oswald. He inspired John Armstrong. And you can see, I mean, there's Oswald, and some of the photos, Oswald has that real thick neck when he's in the Marines. Other photos, he looks kind of like the guy we saw, very kind of wimpy looking and thin. Different hairlines, so many differences in the photos where, and of course, as you mentioned, the impostors were, in the weeks leading up to the assassination, there were several witnesses, Sylvie Odio, people at a firing range, a guy who picked up a hitchhiker, and of course, Albert Bogard, who was a car salesman, who had a very memorable experience with a Lee Oswald that came by there and led him on a high-speed test drive and supposedly made the cryptic comment, maybe I'll have to go back to Russia where a working man can afford a car, things like this. And Oswald, supposedly the Oswald we know historically, couldn't even drive. So clearly it looks like someone was trying to implicate that name of Oswald and connect it with possible violence towards the president in the weeks leading up to the assassination. Whether there was a Harvey and Lee program or not, I don't know. And again, critics disagree on that, but certainly Armstrong came up with some fantastic information, important data out there, people should look at. And I don't think there's any question that, at very least, the people that killed JFK were paving the way to frame Lee Harvey Oswald in the weeks before the assassination.
I mentioned documents. Again, October 26 is the deadline for the Assassination Records Act that was signed 25 years ago. Have there been any new documents that have come to light that will give us more clarity on Lee Harvey Oswald's time in the Soviet Union? I guess what I'm getting at is, are you 100% certain that Oswald's defection to the Soviet Union was, in fact, a false defection?
I'm pretty confident of that. Maybe 99% sure. But what we know, I mean, there's so many files on Oswald. I think some of his tax returns are still classified. We know Ruth and Michael Payne's tax returns are classified. Jack Ruby's tax returns remain classified. Why? Why would that be? But the KGB files on Oswald, first time in Moscow and Minsk, that were obtained by Norman Mailer, who wrote really, you know, kind of a pathetic book late in his life when he had been a pro-conspiracy guy earlier, but then he turned into a neocon and tried to portray Oswald as a lone assassin. But they're now in these files are in the possession of Lawrence Schiller, who is one of these guys who is such a sensationalist. He co-wrote The Scavengers and Critics of the Warren Report years ago, and then later became involved in the JonBenet Ramsey case and wrote kind of a lurid piece on that. But he refuses to turn them over. So there's so many files out there. I mean, we had things like RFK's 1963 date book is missing from the Kennedy Library. Why? I mean, the Secret Service, we know, destroyed documents over and over again, and they blatantly destroyed them when the Assassination Records Review Board requested them in the early 90s. They just destroyed them. And, we had the White House Situation Room message logs. They just end on the morning of the November 22nd, and they're missing through the crucial period of to the 22nd until the November 30th, and they resume again. The White House Communication Agency records are missing, including the tape of, this would be fascinating to hear, there's probably a tape of a Secret Service motorcade radio channel where Roy Kellerman is talking during the third shot. I mean, I've never heard it, but it supposedly exists. And there are tapes of LBJ's car in the Air Force One cockpit. We know that they're still trying to get the tapes. That would be fantastic. I think Bill Kelly is one of the researchers who is trying to get the unedited tapes from Air Force the one cockpit that day, because we don't know exactly what was said, because at this time, again, we know McGeorge Bundy was back in the Situation Room. He's you want a conspirator, that's always one of my favorite conspirators, the National Security Advisor, because he was in the White House Situation Room, and he assured JFK's cabinet, who very curiously was in the air, you know, all in the air at the time, flying back from Hawaii. They were scheduled to go to a conference there. And he assured them very early in the afternoon, and a couple hours after the assassination, that there was no conspiracy and they had the right guy. And this is right after Oswald had been arrested. Nothing was known about him. Certainly he could not possibly, back in Washington, D.C., in the Situation Room, have known there was no conspiracy or that they had the right guy. But that's what he told JFK's cabinet. So you want to look at a conspirator. He's also the one, by the way, who wrote National Security Action Memorandum 273, which was actually written the day of the assassination and would have never been signed by John F. Kennedy. He had to know that because he had just produced National Security Action Memorandum 263, which delineated his plans for total withdrawal from Vietnam. And 273 contradicted that. And, of course, Lyndon Johnson signed it, and the rest is history. It just paved the way for escalation in Vietnam. So
right.
George Clooney is high on my list of suspects.
Well, so many threads there to pick up on. You mentioned Executive Order 263. One of the big losers with Kennedy's plans to de-escalate and pull out all personnel, I think, by 65. So after the next election, it would have been a fait accompli. But one of the big losers would have been Bell Helicopter. And The head of Bell Helicopter, or maybe the second in command, but he was certainly way up there, was Walter Dornberger, who was a guy that escaped the hangman's noose at Nuremberg, was one of these Nazis that was exfiltrated into the United States. And then below him, you have this curious pair of Michael and Ruth Payne. Michael was a Bell Helicopter employee. What are they doing palling around with this loser, supposedly, Lee Harvey Oswald?
Well, sorry, I didn't mean to hit so much information at once. It kind of rolls out of me sometimes. But
No. I mean, you have my head spinning in all the right ways.
Well, and that's one of the questions I've had forever when people talk about Oswald. It's like his best friend was George de Morenschild, who, you know, talk about a background. This guy had dated Jackie Kennedy's mother. So, I mean, he ran in the upper echelons, and he had been connected to the CIA and all kinds of intelligence agencies. This was, just an upper-class, upper-crust guy connected to the Kennedys and intelligence. And he was befriending a minimum-wage loser young enough to be his son and hanging around him. Now, you know, maybe he was interested in Marina. It was very cute, but I don't know that there's any evidence of that. But he... you talk about an odd couple, and certainly the Paynes were that way as well. I mean, and again, their tax records remain secret, and they're still alive. If they had amazingly enough, there aren't too many people alive that are connected to this case still. But Ruth and Michael Payne still are alive, and they could certainly be questioned in any real investigation. But I believe that they know something, and I think at the ground level, because they had that odd living arrangement where Marina Oswald was living with Ruth Payne, and Ruth and Michael were kind of separated but still friendly, and Lee Harvey Oswald was renting a room strangely during the week, and the whole thing was very bizarre, especially for somebody that had no money. But I think they should have been questioned, especially considering we know that Ruth Bain's sister worked for the CIA, and there are lots of, she was a political activist later involved with the Sandinistas and so forth, so lots of interesting connections. There are lots of food there for anyone to ponder if they wanted to have a real investigation back in the day, but no one wanted to do that.
It is a swamp, though, isn't it? Because there are so many threads. Where do you start?
Yeah, exactly, and that's the problem. It's hard to get nailed down. I mean, like when I'm talking about it, I kind of go off into a million different directions because there's so many ways you can approach it. But if I were conducting an investigation, I at the time, I would have concentrated at the ground level, and I would have really grilled the Secret Service because I think they're the most visible. And I talked about that tape earlier of an agent I believe to be Henry Ripka. They probably didn't have that video at that time, but certainly when you can see somebody shrugging and throwing his arms up in frustration, like, why am I being pulled off at the last minute? You question that. You question Emory Roberts, the guy who was in charge of the motorcade, and who apparently called Agent John Reddy back. I was hoping to contact John Reddy, but he died during the course of the book, so I wasn't able to do that because I wanted to find out if it was true that he was actually trying to do his job and jump off the follow-up car and go run and throw himself over Kennedy, which he should have done. They had 6 seconds to do that. No one did anything. Clint Hill ran belatedly. And, was basically helped up on the car by Jackie Kennedy, who was trying to climb out of the limousine, but no one did what they were supposed to do, whereas LBJ's Rufus Youngblood and his Secret Service detail reacted right away and, you know, threw LBJ down to the floor and protected him. No one did that to Kennedy. They had, and that's, that was pointed out by Senator Ralph Yarborough at the time. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but, the Secret Service ought to be trained better the next time, because everyone saw that they didn't. And Vince Palarama, that I mentioned earlier, certainly has made a career out of that. His book is wonderful, Survivor's Guilt, that talks about the Secret Service's lack of performance. I encourage everyone to read that, because he interviewed all these people, and that would be where I'd start an investigation, because I would say, okay, why didn't you do your job? Because it makes no sense. And then from there, we know what McGeorge Bundy was doing. Okay, why were you assuring somebody there was no conspiracy? There are lots of people that you could question at that time, and it kind of would went on. And but the focus always was on Lee Harvey Oswald, and no one else. And when he was killed, then they just had to wrap it up, as Katzenbach said in the memo, and the entire thing became the Warren Report is basically largely a biography of Lee Harvey Oswald, an inaccurate biography.
Right. Right. But, well, you mentioned the Warren Report. We'll probably come back to this before we're finished. But many people, I think, are under the impression that the Warren Report was, or the Warren Commission, they were unanimous, but they were split. Boggs, Hale Boggs, the other two Southern members, Richard Russell and John Sherman Cooper, they wanted nothing to do with the findings of the Warren Commission. And then what happens to Hale Boggs a few years later? He just mysteriously vanishes.
Yeah, and one of those cosmic coincidences, driven to the airport on his flight to Oblivion by a very young Bill Clinton.
Oh.
So if you want to ask, why would somebody, unconnected to anybody before he became a politician, he was very young, how would he be in a position to drive a very, prestigious figure like Hale Boggs to the airport like that? But it was just one of those cosmic coincidences, I call them, but they're everywhere if you look for them.
Oh, indeed. Too many. That's the problem. We're heading into a break. I wanted to ask you, I'll ask the question now, and we'll probably get into it after the break, but that has to do with Jack Ruby and all of these allegations and some evidence, some strong evidence that suggests that Ruby and Oswald knew each other quite well before November 22nd. What say you to that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I go over this in some detail in Hidden History. I mean, there's lots of people from the MC at the Carousel Club, the strippers originally on, but they were told to hush up. A couple of them died unnaturally. They were among the many mysterious deaths connected to the case in the first 3 years. But, yeah, there are lots of people and then later you had the poor girl that was run over, Rose Sheremy.
Okay, listen, I'll jump in. This is a good point of departure. We'll come and pick up on that when we come back with Don Jeffries. As we continue to delve into JFK, here is Jeff Lynn, Mercy Mercy, taking us into the break on Coast to Coast AM. Always a pleasure and an honor to sit in for George Norrie. Please say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. S-Y, because I love you, R-E-T-T. That's Betty Wright, Shirah Shirah. If you're ever feeling a little down, a little blue, depressed even, it can hurt and it can only help, and that is just throw on this record, Betty Wright, Shirah Shirah. It just lifts me up. I can't explain why, but whatever it is, it does the trick. Try it sometime. We will get back to my conversation with Don Jeffries, open up the phone lines as well, take your questions and comments about JFK. Kennedy had actually been the target of a minimum of four assassination attempts before Dallas, one just a month after he was elected president, when a retired postal worker, his car was loaded with dynamite, and he followed the president-elect from Hyannisport to Georgetown to Palm Beach. And Kennedy supposedly said, "Brother, they could have gotten me in Palm Beach. There's no way to keep anyone from killing me." This is what he said to a Secret Service agent shortly before the suspect was apprehended in JFK's last 100 days. This was recounted by Thurston Clark. There were two other assassination plots, one in Chicago, one in Tampa. They were uncovered in the weeks before, of course, the final and unfortunately successful assassination attempt in November 22nd of 63. All right. Just a reminder that a subscription to the Coast Insiders Club is a great value for fans of the show. It also makes a terrific gift. Just for 15 cents a day, you get over 1,800 previous Coast to Coast shows for immediate download, a high-quality live broadcast, podcasts via iTunes or our Android and iPhone apps, as well as access to our twice-monthly live chat sessions. It's real easy to sign up. Just go to coasttocoastam.com. Back with more of my conversation and your calls for Don Jeffries, JFK, when Coast to Coast AM continues. And we are back with Don Jeffries, author of Hidden History, and his latest is Survival of the Richest. How can people get either Hidden History or the latest Survival of the Richest, Don?
They're available on Amazon. They're in just about all the Barnes & Noble stores. The publisher is Skyhorse Publishing for both of them. It's available just on any place you'd buy any other book. You can easily Google it and find the best deal you can out there.
All right, we were talking about the death list, the JFK death list before the break, and just give us a sense of the scope, the magnitude of, you know, the number of witnesses to the JFK assassination, where these individuals have met either mysterious or sudden deaths.
Well, it was enough for one reporter, Penn Jones, to write four very good books for the Forgive My Grief series about it. He was later the publisher of the Continuing Inquiry. He specialized in the unnatural deaths, and it's just incredible if you look at it. And they, you know, we had a slew of them in the first 3 years after the assassination, and then you had a bunch in the time leading right up to the House assassinations, this House Select Committee assassinations investigation in the mid-70s, including the person I mentioned earlier, George de Morenschild, who supposedly shot himself right after talking to reporter Edward Epstein. Bill O'Reilly had investigated that, a young Bill O'Reilly earlier on, too. John Roselli and, mobsters like that. These people were dropping like flies when the HSCA was involved. And you've had them, you know, basically, like I said, there's not too many people left that are connected to it, but people it's connected to all of these events. And anybody who's read Hidden History knows that most of these events feature a lot of unnatural deaths, but the JFK assassination, boy, I call it the mother of all conspiracies, and it certainly has more unnatural deaths connected to it than any other case I know.
I still can't believe that the person who drove Warren Commission member Hale Boggs to the airport before he disappeared was a young Bill Clinton. I mean, that just defies all.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't write that stuff.
No, you can't. Well, yeah, actually, truth. All of this stuff is stranger than fiction. You couldn't. I mean, I tried to incorporate a lot of this into my science fiction novel, The Unreals, and it's hard to do because it's hard to get anything more fantastic than the reality is. But the connections are everywhere. I call them cosmic coincidences, and these things are interlaced. And you know, Hale Boggs, of course, is his daughter is Cokie Roberts, and actually, the person that went with Hale Boggs was a congressman named Bekich at that time, whose own son is a congressman right now. He's a congressman. There's a, one of his sons is a congressman. The other guy is a conspiracy guy who Jesse Ventura and Nick Bekich interviewed on his conspiracy show. There's a lot of interesting connections there.
All right, to the wild card line, Joe joins us from the Bronx. Hey, Joe, welcome.
Hey, Richard, how are you, Richard?
Well, thank you.
Good. And I wanted to ask Don now, I understand recently they've declassified some of Jack Ruby's documents along with a couple of personal items of his, pair of brass knuckles and his gun holster. What can you tell me about those documents that were declassified? They're now part of the Texas School Book Depository Museum. And can you shed a little light on Lee Harvey Oswald's life in the Bronx? I understand he lived on the Grand Concourse.
Well, I would suggest if you really want to know about Lee Harvey Oswald's life, and I think that was Harvey, according to John Armstrong. Because again, you know, there's so many things. He was going to the school in New York at the same time as in Louisiana and Texas. They were all in there, and that's why a lot of people believe there were actually two Oswalds, and certainly John Armstrong makes a compelling case. As far as the Ruby documents, I don't know of anything astounding that came out of that. I haven't studied in depth, but I do know that his tax records are apparently still classified, which I find unbelievable. I don't know what kind of an excuse there would be for that.
Thanks for the call, Joe. There's a great, famous Jack Ruby quote. He made a statement to reporters after he had been permitted a new trial, and he said that everything pertaining to what's happening has never come to the surface. The world will never know the true facts of what occurred, my motives. The people had so much to gain, had such an ulterior motive for putting me in the position I'm in, will never let the true facts come above board to the world. What do you it's obviously we know what he was talking about, but why isn't more attention paid to that, to Ruby's statement to that reporter?
Boy, some reporters out of it, but and they'll tell you in the next breath, well, he supposedly made a deathbed confession on, and it was released as an audio record where he said there was no conspiracy. Well, that video, and it's a video, and I believe it's a follow-up question. One of the reporters said, were those people in positions of high powers, Jack? And he says, yes. So I don't know what more of an admission you can get than that. I mean, there's the letter that supposedly was smuggled out that Penn Jones published from Jack Ruby in prison. Still not sure it was actually him, where he talked about Lyndon Johnson specifically and so forth, but clearly Ruby was a big piece of the puzzle, and he had all the interesting connections himself. I mean, Ruby went back. He had worked as a youngster for Al Capone back in the 1930s. So, you know, it's amazing the connections you find in this, but I don't see any reason for any of these things to be classified. It's ridiculous. But on the other hand, the Warren Report did publish Jack Ruby's mother's dental records charts, and as Mark Lane and Jim Garrison both said, that wouldn't have been pertinent even if Jack Ruby had bit Oswald to death. So, you know, that's the kind of evidence
that's out there. Oh, dear. Wild card line again. Woody's in Whitehall, Pennsylvania. Hello, Woody. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Oh, hi. Terrific show, Richard and Don.
Thank you.
I had a question about Oswald. If he was actually involved in the shooting and say he wasn't set up, wouldn't he have had some kind of well-rehearsed exit plan rather than kind of running helter-skelter around the city?
Or sitting and waiting in the Texas theater for him to be arrested.
Yeah, well, his plan, if you believe the official explanation, his plan was to walk away from the scene of the crime, which makes sense, and then proceed back towards take a bus back towards the scene of the crime, and then get out, and after letting a woman get a taxi cab, take a taxi cab with William Whaley, who was you want to read some hilarious testimony. William Whaley was such a bad witness. He admitted at the end of his testimony, he goes, I don't want to mess your investigation up, but a good defense attorney could tear me apart. William Whaley went on to become the first Dallas taxi driver to be killed while driving on duty, I think, in 40 years, too. So, again, one of the many witnesses that died mysteriously. But, yeah, Oswald certainly would have, and he certainly wouldn't have kept, we're told that he wanted to make himself a big man and restore his name in history, which is the same thing they said about James O'Reilly and Sirhan, yet they all protested their innocence. I mean, Oswald over and over again said, no, I didn't do it, and the chances he got. So I don't know how that translates into, trying to prove that you're somebody if you're denying that you did it.
Woody, thanks for the call. To the wild card line yet again, Chris is in Columbus, Ohio. Good morning, good evening, Chris, and welcome to Coast to Coast AM.
Yes, a long-time Coast Insider, too. I have like 3 points and actually a personal point I want to make that will make you feel good. One point I wanted to make was the guest's opinion. Was the space program, Kennedy and Khrushchev, it's documented that they were going to merge, which I believe that there's a secret underground government that did not want our space program and Russia's to work together. Also, Lee Harvey Oswald on one of the Coast to Coast shows was a lab technician for the polio vaccine. And also, third, I'd like to make a point of deathbed confessions that are all over YouTube about CIA agents, Secret Service guys, all of those making their deathbed confessions on the assassination. Also, the good thing that will make you feel good was one day, 10 years ago, 15, I was driving up 77 on my way home late at night, and a Lincoln Continental passed me, brand new, and as it passed me, I looked, and the license plate said Kennedy. So I thought, that can't be. I'm going to drive up and drive beside the guy and maybe give him a wave if it's who I think it is. So I did. And it was John Jr., and he waved back, and I just backed off and let him drive on.
Amazing.
Okay, I'd like to get your opinion on that, and tell me what you think.
All right. The idea of Oswald working on this polio vaccine, which supposedly, you know, there was a simian cancer virus associated with it, all highlighted in Dr. Mary's Monkey.
Yeah, that's related to Judith Berry. So, again, I think, and then we had, you know, I believe it was Dr. Mary Sherman that certainly died strangely, and I think there was Nicholas Jett, I believe, the coroner. I think there were a couple really strange unnatural deaths that were connected to that. I have not read Dr. Mary's Monkey. I'm aware there's a lot of controversy about it, but I think there's clearly something there. We know David Ferry was doing some kind of strange cancer research as well, where he had a bunch of mice around his apartment and so forth, and So I don't know, again, how valid it is, again, because Judith Ferry is kind of a controversial witness, but there's something there. There's something there, regardless.
And what about the joint space program with the Kennedy and Khrushchev were planning?
You know, there are theories on that, and of course there's lots of arguments that the entire space program was a hoax. You know, so you got theories all around there. I doubt if that would have been, you know, one of the major primary reasons that Kennedy would have been assassinated. I don't think that would have been as important a reason as obviously Vietnam or the CIA or just general distrust by the corporate world and the military-industrial complex.
I want to go to east of the Rockies. Glenn is in Harlingen, Texas. Glenn, good morning, good evening. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Good morning, Richard, Don. How you doing?
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
It's Harlingen. But anyway, I'm going to play devil's advocate here in favor of Oswald making the shots. Now, our friend Oliver Stone showed a bumbling buffoon who couldn't hold a rifle. And Oswald was left-handed in actuality. He had the Carcano on a tripod, and it was a right-handed service rifle, of course. And in that configuration, a left-handed person can shoot a bolt-action rifle almost as fast as a semi-automatic. And Don, what is the distance in feet from the window to the president's car?
Well, I'm aware where you're probably going with this, and that is it. That it looks a lot in person. It looks like it wasn't much of a shot, but the fact is, no one's ever duplicated. I've never heard Oswald's left hand. In fact, the original critics made a great deal about it by saying that one of the original things was saying that it was made for the scope was made for a left-handed shooter, and Oswald wasn't left-handed. He was tested twice in the Marine Corps that I know of. His last time, he barely made by 1 point the lowest of the three designations that the Marine have, I believe, was marksman. So, and Mark Lane originally checked, and when he actually got a quote from the Marine Corps where he asked for, basically, he showed Oswald's record, it says, as far as whether it's Nelson Dogato talking about his Maggie's doors that he got on his shots all the time. And the Marine Corps admitted to him that his shooting scores indicated a rather poor shot. So that was their assessment of him as well. I don't think there's any credible evidence. We talk about Marina's kind of fanciful testimony, but there's no credible evidence that he ever practiced with a weapon after leaving the Marine Corps. So I don't think you get better as a shooter without practicing. So I just think that's a dead end. I think there's so much evidence that Oswald was not the shooter. And I believe, like Jim Garrison believed, I believe Oswald was an undercover agent of some kind for the government. I believe he was infiltrating what he was told was a plot to kill JFK at the time of the assassination. That's why he was so easy to set up as the patsy.
Glenn, thank you. Great points raised there. Do you believe it was Oswald who tried to warn the Secret Service about the plot in Chicago?
Sure looks like it. Sure looks like it. I think it probably was.
The other thing about the rifle was, I seem to recall that someone described Oswald arriving at the book depository building with something wrapped in paper or newspaper, and he said it was curtain rods. But the idea was that the rifle was disassembled. And if you had to put the scope back on a rifle, you'd have to test it. You'd have to test it in the field to align it properly.
Yeah,
obviously, he couldn't do that on the sixth floor of the Texas Book Depository building.
You're talking about Buell Wesley Fraser, who wrote him to work that morning, and Oswald vehemently supposedly denied and said he did not bring a package like that of so-called curtain rods. There's a couple schools of thought on that. Supposedly Jack Daugherty was the person who saw him enter work that day and said he was carrying nothing but a lunch sack, which is what Oswald claimed he was carrying. So I don't know whether there are other people that think that he was told to bring a gun there. There have been other weapons in the depository. There are people that look into the backgrounds of everybody that worked in it. You can get at the depository. You can go so far down the rabbit hole here that you can go into any different areas of study. But I think, however you look at it, I don't think Lee Harvey Oswald was the shooter that day.
Let's quickly work in Blair in Sedona, Arizona. Blair, good evening. Good morning.
Oh, thank you, Richard. And Mr. Jeffries, I saw President Kennedy at Charter Day, UC Berkeley, in 1962, when he said the purpose of college education is not merely to advance the economics of self-interest, but it's also important to the maintenance of a free society, that its citizens be well-educated. Well, somebody gave me this little card that says, and I want to see if this is validated to you, "We are not afraid to entrust the American people with unpleasant facts, foreign ideas, alien philosophies, and competitive values. For a nation that is afraid to let its people judge the truth and falsehood in an open market is a nation that is afraid of its people." Now, is that a true statement from Mr. Kennedy?
Yeah, I've heard that statement, and certainly it's one of the many things he said that I think most of us can agree with.
All right, Blair, thank you for that. Well, I think this idea of a free exchange of ideas on college campuses, I think the 35th president would be doing 360s in his grave right about now, unfortunately. Don, as always, time goes by too quickly. I really appreciate you hanging out with me and us for the last 2 hours. And again, how do people get a hold of Hidden History? Are both editions still available, the first and second edition?
Yeah, the hardback's still available, and the paperback edition has, as you mentioned, the new foreword by Roger Stone. It also has a bibliography, which mistakenly wasn't in the hardback version, if people are interested in that. And yeah, they can get both my books. Like I said, they're both Skyhorse Publishing, and they're available on Amazon, and they're still in Barnes. I know Survival of the Rich is in all the Barnes & Noble stores, and Hidden History probably still is, too, so... You can get them in bookstores if you want to go that route. Buy them online there, or virtually anywhere. You Google it, you'll find it in lots of places.
And Don, give us a website.
I blog at donaldjeffries.wordpress.com. My blog is called Keeping It Unreal. I write pretty regularly about current events and historical things, so people can keep up with me there if they're interested.
Thanks again, Don. Appreciate it. All right, when we come back, open lines. Bring your A material. Here's Rodriguez taking us into the break with I Wonder on Coast to Coast AM.